Poets, rock stars, authors, and even we mere mortals all share a nightly sojourn, a temporary stay in the land of dreams. Today's guest argues that they are not just flights of fancy, but critical to health and happiness in our waking hours. She's Alice Robb this week on Story in the Public Square. And welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. To do that, we sit down every week with the best storytellers around, authors, journalists, filmmakers, and more, to make sense of the big stories shaping public life in the United States today. To help us this week, we're joined by Alice Robb, a science writer whose works have been published in the New York Times, The New Republic, and Elle, among many other outlets. She's also the author of a new book, Why We Dream. Alice, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So we came across your sort of wonderful essay in the New York Times Sunday Review late last year, and this introduced us to your book, which is magnificent.
Thank you.
Tell us about sort of your journey to becoming a writer, a science writer in particular.
I've wanted to be a writer for about as long as I remember. And I did a little bit of journalism in college, not too much, and then just started interning straight out of college. My first internship was I answered an online ad for an unnamed women's website and started working for them, which then turned out to be Bustle. And then after that, I got an internship at the New Republic and moved down to DC for a year and then started covering science for them.
What attracts you to science writing in particular?
I just love the stories behind the science. And I'm really fascinated by human nature and by questions of, you know, what culture is and what it is to be human. I mean, I studied anthropology and archaeology as an undergraduate. And I just found that you can't look at those big questions without looking at science. And that there weren't that many people looking at, you know, the characters and the stories of discoveries. And I just found that I really loved covering it.
So you said you like to write as long as you can remember. So that means since you were a child. Do you remember any of your early stories? Because I share the same sort of career path in that sense. I like to write from a very early age. Were you doing fiction, poetry, early journalism? What was... We had your notebooks back then. What would we find in there, do you think?
So for another project I'm working on, I actually went back through these boxes in my childhood bedroom recently and found this sort of early autofiction. I think I thought I wanted to be a fiction writer, but everything I was writing was just true and often about myself. I gave myself various other names, but they were all about like a girl who wanted to be a writer and lived in New York.
So you could have been a memoirist, actually. So your passion for writing and researching about dreams started on a trip to Peru. You introduced the book, actually, with that trip. Tell those of us in our audience who have not read the book and may not be familiar with your work, what was that trip about and what happened?
So when I was in college, I studied archaeology. And as a course requirement, we had to go on an archaeological dig. And I went on this excavation in Peru with a few of my classmates, and we were living in this tiny village with very limited internet access and, you know, no bookstores. And I just sort of ran out of stuff to do. I read all the novels I'd brought with me. And my friend happened to have this book about lucid dreaming, which I'd never heard of. And I learned from the book that lucid dreams are when you are in a dream and you become aware that you're in a dream. And sometimes you're able to control the plot of the dream. And I thought that was a pretty exciting idea.
Now, this is distinct from sort of like a sleep disorder, right? Where you're sort of aware of, you become consciousness, but you still have sleep paralysis. That's not what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's different.
Okay.
This is like an enjoyable thing. Sleep paralysis, while I've never experienced it, sounds very terrifying.
It is. So.
So what is a lucid dream then? I mean, give us an example. It sounds the way you're describing it now, almost as if you're in a movie, but then you also direct the movie. I mean, that's a cinematic parallel. Yeah. Maybe that's not correct, but.
Well, sometimes it is. I mean, a lot of people learned about lucid dreaming from the movie Inception, which came out in 2010, which kind of plays with the idea that in a lucid dream, you can construct worlds and you can do whatever you want. For most people, I mean, lucid dreams, like all dreams, are idiosyncratic. So for some people, you might just have an awareness that you're in a dream, especially if you're just starting to learn to lucid dream. Eventually, you might be able to, you know, really direct what happens and fly around and use them to break out of nightmares or reunite with people who have died. And I met one woman who used lucid dreaming to help her anxiety issues. She was able to sort of hypnotize herself within a lucid dream and tell herself not to be anxious, and found that had a really helpful effect on her waking life.
Wow. So you're in Peru. You read this book by Stephen LaBerge. Am I pronouncing that correctly? And it's called Exploring the World of Lucid Dreaming. Mm-hmm. You read it, and at first you kind of rolled your eyes. Why? And that's actually a phrase from your introduction.
Yeah.
Why did you roll your eyes? I guess you had never had a lucid dream?
I hadn't, and I'm just kind of a skeptical person.
You're a science writer.
Yeah.
You need to be skeptical.
Seemed a little too good to be true. Seemed a little new agey. But you know, he seemed legitimate. He had a PhD. And then, so I started doing his exercises. So the main one is that he suggests you ask yourself throughout the day whether you're awake or asleep. And that you get in the habit of doing that, and you do something with your body too. So you might, you know, poke your hand with your finger, and if your finger goes through your hand, then you know you're in a dream. You get in the habit of doing things like that throughout the day, then you'll ask yourself the same question in a dream, because we dream about what we do and what we think about. And if you're sufficiently aware, you'll answer that you're dreaming, and you'll start having a lucid dream.
So you, after reading the book, you began doing these exercises, and you had a lucid dream. Did you believe it when sort of like is there a moment of incredulity that you sort of say, wait, did that really just happen? Tell us about that first experience.
I mean, it was kind of mind-blowing. I just couldn't believe it. Like, I still remember this dream, and it was 8 or 9 years ago now. I was, first I was asleep in this sort of bunk bed in Peru, and then I was swimming in a pool, and I was aware that I was both swimming in a pool and I could feel the water, and it felt very vivid and very real, and I was also aware that I was lying in bed, and it was just really trippy. And then I believed in lucid dreaming.
So tell us about why is this important? It's on one hand, it seems like a good party trick, right? You can control your dreams, right? But is there physical health benefit, mental health benefit? What's the upside for all of this?
Well, there certainly can be. I mean, and you can talk about regular dreaming in the same way in terms of the benefits that it provides. I mean, with lucid dreaming, people who have recurrent nightmares, which are pretty difficult to treat, often find that if they can go into a lucid dream and change the ending, you know, chase away the monster instead of letting it chase them, or banish the bully at the crucial moment, then the recurrent nightmare will stop. So they can be useful for those kinds of things. They're also just really cool. I mean, it's this whole state of consciousness that we have access to, or we at least have the potential to access, that most people are not exploring.
Want to get into the mental health aspects a little bit further in this conversation, but you use the term adventure for dreams. Mm-hmm. I mean, dreams can be many things to many people, obviously. What do you mean by adventure?
Well, I think most of us now talk about sleep. When we talk about sleep and how important it is, we're thinking about what it can do for us during our waking lives. And, you know, we all know how it feels to have pulled an all-nighter, not gotten good sleep. You feel bad. Your memory is worse. You look worse. You feel worse. But we're also living while we're asleep. This is whole 8 hours or, 7 hours that you're experiencing, and that you can, even people who think they don't dream are very likely dreaming every night, every time they have a REM cycle. So, and it's not hard to remember more of those dreams and just know what we're doing. I mean, we're doing all kinds of crazy things during that time or imagining them.
So I've read, you've written about, what people can do to help remember their dreams. If they think that they're not dreaming, what are some things that people can do if they want to try to remember more dreams?
The most important thing is just wanting to remember your dreams and believing that dreams are interesting and important. If you just before bed tell yourself, I want to remember my dreams, if you keep a dream journal, and it doesn't have to be, pen and paper, you can type it into the Notes app on your phone, you can speak it into your phone. But just getting in the habit of doing that as soon as you wake up, before you start engaging with the real world and, making coffee and starting to stress about what's going on in the day.
Is there, at some point, and I think that this is something that you've written, I read that the vast majority of dreams that people have are associated with negative emotions, fear, anxiety, danger.
Mm-hmm.
What's the upside of remembering things like that? I mean, a lot of us, we don't want to remember those sort of negative things, right? So what's the upside of confronting those?
Well, they can clue us into things that are important to, unconscious desires or fears. And we're doing a lot of important work emotionally and psychologically in our sleep that if we can then reflect on. We tend to dream about things. Yes, some of our dreams are just kind of mundane. Maybe they don't mean much. But a lot of them really are, showing us things that we haven't faced up to in the daytime. And if you can just pay attention to those, you have a better chance of addressing them.
You mentioned that dreams can help in the awake state with problem solving. This would mm-hmm. be one of the mental health benefits, or one of the benefits just in general. What do you mean by helping with problem solving? I mean, I think you sort of hinted at it there, but...
Yeah, depends what kind of problems you're solving. There are lots of stories of artists and musicians and writers using their dreams in their work and using them for new ideas to get over a hump. Because when we dream, we're thinking in this unique state where our frontal lobes, the logic centers of the brain, are less active, and the emotional centers, like the amygdala, are more active. We're drawing from different sources, from the distant past and the recent past, and we're mixing it up, and we're just coming up with non-obvious solutions to problems, whether they're creative and were, Paul McCartney writing yesterday, or writers like Charlotte Bronte and Graham Greene were famous for using their dreams in their work, Stephen King, or we're just thinking about, a regular problem at work or with family.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard 4 times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with an immensely talented crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to catch up with me on Twitter, you can do so at JM Lutis. Joining me, as he does every week, is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller, An award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal, Wayne is also the author of 17 books. You can find Wayne on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller, all one word. And our guest this week is the immensely talented Alice Robb, a science writer whose works have been published in leading newspapers and magazines, and who is also the author of a remarkable new book, Why We Dream. You can follow her on Twitter, too, at Alice L. Robb, A-L-I-C-E-L-R-O-B-B.
Another area you mentioned is, and I'm quoting you here, preparation for life.
Mm-hmm.
And what does that mean? How do dreams help us for preparing for life? And I guess what is preparing for life, short of getting up in the morning and preparing your coffee and three cups of tea?
So as you mentioned, when scientists started studying dreams more systematically in the mid-20th century, one of the first things they were struck by was that dreams are overwhelmingly unpleasant. The most common, you know, we're being chased, we're being, we're in danger. And when evolutionary psychologists started to think about this, they thought about why would we do something so unpleasant? And one answer is that we're using our dreams to rehearse for dangerous, our ancestors, as they might have rehearsed for life-threatening situations. They're practicing hunting, and which would also explain why a lot of our dreams take us into these kind of primal environments, where even if we live in the city, often people will dream of being, you know, chased by wild animals that have no relevance to their life. So in modern life, for example, many, many people have some version of the exam dream, where
right here. Yeah. I think pretty much everyone I know has had some version of the exam dream.
Yeah, I mean, mine is, I turn up to where I went to college. We had to wear, there was a very strict dress code for
exams. You went to Oxford, let's say where you went to college.
We had to wear robes for exams, and they were very strictly, the dress code was very strictly enforced, so I've turned up to exams and I'm wearing, you know, the wrong color carnation in my robe, and so I'm expelled. But the idea is that we have these dreams when we're stressed about something else. So, and you wake up for the, there was a study just a few years ago of French medical students that looked at the dreams they'd had over the course of the semester and compared them to the students' performance on the final exam, and found that the best students, all the five best students, had had nightmares about the exam. So they were late, they couldn't find the test center, one was writing in invisible ink. And the idea is that we wake up from these dreams and we think about it and we think, okay, well, you know, maybe I'm not as prepared as I want, but at least I'm not gonna write in invisible ink. And you feel more confident in real life. You've confronted this worst case scenario.
So you channel what I guess you might call a mildly bad dream or a kind of a scary dream into something positive and life-changing, at least at some level, when you're awake. So
exactly.
You take what you dreamed about and you work on it. Which brings me to another related question here. It would seem to me, and it is actually true, that dreams would be helpful for people who are seeing a therapist or in therapy, mm-hmm. or seeing a psychiatrist. Talk about that. I mean, that's sort of a subspecialty, as it were.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Freud most famously, of course,
right.
Put dreams at the center of psychoanalysis, and wrote about how, he believed that dreams could really hold the key to unraveling our unconscious and figuring out the source of our neuroses. But even today, many therapists find that dreams can be just a window into people's problems, and that it can be easier for people to talk about something that's happened in a dream than to just confess something. It's just, dreams feel less, because their sources are less obvious, you can always kind of blame it on some, you know, just some misfiring of the neurons. And it just makes it easier to talk about issues.
So a good therapist would know that dream meant something more than just, like, I showed up for the exam and had invisible ink.
I mean, right. I mean,
the therapist would know that that indicated something that might need addressing, as opposed to just, well, you know, it's a dream.
Right. I mean, I think it's you know, hard to talk about a single dream meaning anything necessarily, but they can always be, whether you're working with a therapist or just thinking about your life, you know, what other emotions does it bring up? Does it bring up something that reminds you of something that's going on in your life?
I can remember when I was in graduate school, I had a recurring nightmare about being in a play mm-hmm. and not knowing the lines beyond the immediate scene that we were performing. Mm-hmm. And I stopped having that nightmare when I finished my PhD.
Really?
Like that dream completely went away, and I realized in retrospect that, and it was always a different play, but it was always the sort of same scenario, and I realized in retrospect that that was about fearing, you know, finishing, people being exposed for the fraud that I was, right, and not knowing all my lines, not finishing the PhD. So talk to us about the kind of dream that nobody, we all have nightmares, nobody likes them, but you spent an entire chapter of the book talking about nightmares. And that's different than sort of your run-of-the-mill sort of negative, you know, mildly bad dream. Nightmares are something different, right?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was important to devote some space to nightmares, even though they kind of, you know, they go against the overall argument of my book that dreams are great mm-hmm. and fun, because nightmares are neither of those things. So lots of dreams are just mildly unpleasant, but nightmares can be really terrifying. They can wake you up in the middle of the night. They can, among PTSD patients, they can be debilitating, flashbacks of the trauma that interfere with their recovery. And nightmares are sometimes thought of as a children's problem, but they persist in adults, more commonly among women than men. From around the teenage years, women overtake men in nightmare disorder.
Is there science that says it's different than just a run-of-the-mill dream, but it's just a worse topic? I mean, is there something else going on in the human brain with a nightmare?
I mean, you can have the same physiological stress response that you have in real life, which can cause you to wake up and interfere with sleep. But that stress response has been associated with, sometimes migraine patients say that they will have nightmares precipitating their migraines, and it's possible that the stress of those nightmares are contributing to the migraines. And there are other, you know, examples of negative physiological consequences.
I want to go back to something you said earlier about ancient times and fear responses. And does neuroscience give us an answer to why we even dream at all? I mean, the fear response, if you go back to cave dwelling times, to use that example, was a survival instinct. Does neuroscience tell us anything about why we even dream? I mean, you've given us obviously the benefits and in the case of nightmares, some of the detriments to dreaming, but is that something you looked at in your book?
I mean, I'd say the whole book is sort of exploring that question, and there's a lot of that remains somewhat mysterious about dreams.
And I would think
some of the science we're still working on it. But there's a lot, you know, just in terms of learning, which I think we haven't talked about as much, and how dreaming helps us consolidate new information and incorporate recent experiences into our long-term memory system. People have a massive increase in REM sleep when they're learning something, having an intensive new learning experience. So, when you're learning a new language, there's a stereotype that you are, you know, you're fluent in a language when you start to dream in it. And it's,
really?
My ninth grade French teacher told me that, and I'm still waiting to dream in French. But,
but there was actually a study of students who were learning French in an intensive course that found that they were having, especially the ones who were improving, were having a huge increase in REM sleep when most dreaming occurs.
The longest chapter is how we forgot about dreams. And it's a history going back really to ancient times and then coming up through the present. Talk about the early days of civilized life, as it were, when dreams were cherished or mm-hmm. understood or at least held to be important, and then there was a period when that kind of all went out the door. What happened? What was the change?
So one of the reasons I wanted to write this book was to explore this paradox that it's in modern times most of us don't put that much stock in our dreams, but that's kind of anomalous historically and around the world. So, I mean, we have dream diaries dating back thousands of years. We have, attempts at dream dictionaries, people trying to use dreams to make predictions about the future and to make decisions. And, you know, there are examples of societies where people would wake up in the middle of the night and talk about their dreams. There are accounts by missionaries among Native Americans in the U.S. and Canada writing about how, about people acting out their dreams and incorporating them into ceremonies. And they were just they have been in various places much more integrated into life and much more seen as a more valid topic of conversation.
One of the, we got about 30 seconds left here, but one of the things that has come out of the publication of your book is that people are now coming together to talk about their dreams. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so one of the things that I did for the book is I wanted to address this stereotype that dreams are boring. And lots of people say this. I mean, there was an episode of This American Life where they say dreams are among the seven most boring topics of conversation, like right up there with, I don't know, menstruation and the traffic. And I attended this dream group where it was like a group of like seven people all analyzing one person's dream together for an hour, which sounds like it could be the most boring thing in the world. And it was actually totally fascinating and led to all these revelations. And this group kept meeting we've been meeting now for 2 years.
Well, we'll do that on the next episode. but Alice, thank you so much for being with us. She's Alice Raub. The book is Why We Dream. That is all the time we have this week. But if you want to know more about Storying the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter or visit pellcenter.org. We can always find previous episodes. He's G. Wayne Miller. I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Storying the Public Square.